Interstate Batteries offers a wide variety of batteries for your everyday needs. Stop into one of their thousands of retail locations and talk with a battery specialist about batteries for your truck, trail cameras, and even those weird batteries for your rangefinder. Interstate Batteries even offers cell phone repair in certain locations. For more information, visit interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
The Houseman XP Podcast Network is taking you on the journey. Your host, Master Trainer Heath Hyatt, will combine his decades of experience as a houndsman and as a professional trainer that will light the path forward and make our packs lighter on this lifelong journey to become better hunters and houndsmen. There are no shortcuts, so lace up those boots and grab a dog leash. The journey begins now.
Hey guys, the journey on Houndsman XP is teamed up with Go Wild. Go Wild is a social media platform that was made for hunters by hunters. If you guys and gals have listened to any of the other podcasts that I've been on, you know what a huge outdoor enthusiast I am. I love being in the woods with my hounds. There's nothing more exciting than hearing the thunder of a spring gobbler. I love fishing for trout in the brooks and the streams, and I love being on the river chasing that ever-elusive fish of a thousand casts, the muskie. Go Wild is the place that I can post my trophies, hunts, and memories without being censored. But Go Wild is so much more than that. It's a place to share your stories, sharpen your skills, hone your tactics, get gear reviews, and shop for anything outdoors. When you make a purchase from the Go Wild store, everything is free shipping. Anything that you purchase anywhere in the country, no matter how big, free shipping. So go down to the show notes, click on the Go Wild link at the bottom, and get signed up today. And let's go wild.
Hey Heath, I need to jump in front of you to take care of this drawing. So Houndsman XP hit 1 million downloads in the month of September. And part of that celebration, we said that we would do a drawing for people that guessed the correct date. Well, we had several people that guessed September 15th as the date. And we're going to do that drawing in this pre-roll for this show. Guys, it's going to take me just a second here. I'm going to stick to the tradition that Seth Hall has put out, and I'm going to have the dog bowl ready with the names of the eligible participants. You can hear the names clanking around in the bowl there. But what we're going to get done here is I'm going to draw this name, and then you're going to the winner, the person that I draw out. You can find all the information on what's included over on Houndsman XP Podcast Group or the Houndsman XP Podcast page. We've made several posts about it, and it's going to be a pretty nice package. I know there's a handmade knife and some other great prizes there. So I'm going to draw this, and then we're going to rock on over to this podcast where Heath is going to interview Alex with his Leicas. But let's get this drawing done first. All right, here we go, folks. Mixing it up. Mixing those names up in the bowl. I'm going to pull one person out of here. I think this is so awesome. The set started using a dog bowl for our drawings. With all the spinner wheels and everything out there, you know, we're keeping it simple and keeping it on message with a dog bowl. All right, we got Brody Grindstaff. You guessed the correct date of September 15th. Again, that's Brody Grindstaff. Brody, reach out to us at, I'm going to just give you my email address, chris.houndsmanxp@gmail.com. I'm going to need your shipping address and your all that stuff. So if you want to get a prize package, you got to reach out to me. Let me know. I don't know where you live, buddy. So, Brody, congratulations. Thanks for participating. And thanks to all of our listeners who helped us achieve 1 million downloads. We also have another drawing going on right now, and that is for us to award people who are giving us a current review on Apple Podcasts. And all you got to do is go over to Apple Podcast. We prefer that five-star rating up there. Just click that five-star and then just write a line or two. A lot of you are doing that right now, but there's still a really good chance to win another great prize package. I know there's a custom oil portrait or painting. I'm not sure if it's oil. It might be acrylic. But anyway, it's going to be a custom painting of your hound. So you got that memorable favorite hound. You got a good picture of that hound. We've contracted an artist to give you something that you can hang on your wall that'll be a keepsake forever. That's just one of them. And again, you can find out all the details on that drawing on the Houndsman XP podcast Facebook or on the Houndsman XP Instagram accounts. All right, Heath, I'm going to kick it over to you, buddy. Take it away.
Today on the journey, we are going to stay here in Southwest Virginia, not West Virginia, West Virginia. We are here in Reiner. We're at the Hacienda. I'm looking out on the ridge, and leaves are starting to change just a little bit. It's dry. It's been really dry for the last couple weeks, even though we've had thunderstorms through August. But we are going to be here today with Alex, and I'm not going to pronounce his last name because I will butcher it, but Alex is running some interesting dogs on Bear. I've been intrigued by this for about a year now, and I actually have a guy that I back home, Nate or Jason Spicer, that's running some of these dogs, and we're going to learn about the Leicas today. We're going to kind of learn where they originated from, what they were bred for, and what piqued his interest in these running these dogs on Bear. You know, most of us are houndsmen, and hounds are a traditional dog that we run. But, I mean, Alex is catching Bear and doing it pretty consistently. So we're going to sit back and just enjoy this part of the journey. So, Alex, pronounce your last name so I'm not having to do it.
The full name is Alexander Kurashev. But I go by Alex. Yep. It's just easier.
And Northern Virginia, you're inside that D.C. commute.
Yep.
Which is absolutely torture if nobody's been through the D.C. Beltway and have to sit in traffic for hours.
Yeah, well, so I do some bow hunting for deer.
Uh-huh.
And it just gives me the additional motivation to get up early and drive to my tree stand way before the traffic starts. Because if I'm late, it's not even, you know, it's still dark out, but there are people just lined up. Even 45 minutes from D.C., you got to be there in that tree stand early before the traffic starts.
So do you hunt close to the...
I have several properties. Are you talking about deer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I can hunt in my backyard. It's just kind of small.
Right.
But I have several properties within 10, 15, 20 minutes drive.
I gotcha.
But they're all smaller properties, what they call urban bow hunting.
Right.
So, you know, it's not uncommon for me to pull back and wait for a bus stop to load up all the kids, and then it starts taking off and I release the arrow.
But, you know, there's some pretty good bucks in those urban areas.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Are you seeing those?
Yeah, yeah. But a lot of people come, you know, they believe that bow hunting in urban areas is easy, and you'd see those deer, you're driving through the neighborhood, or you're walking, you can even be walking with your dog, and you see them deer like 20 yards to the left, and they're not going nowhere.
Right.
But as soon as you put on that cam and you start sneaking in, they know something is up, they take off, or if they smell something new, they know what all the local dogs smell like, they know, you know, all the people that go hiking and whatever, or cutting their grass, they know them all. If some new smell is there, it's not easy.
They're harder than what people think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you see where I live. Before deer season, you'll see, I mean, I seen three deer right here behind the dog lot yesterday right at dusk dark. They come up to the apple tree, and literally the apple tree's within 10 foot of my dog lot. The deer were standing right outside it. Now, when season comes in, mm-hmm. you will not see them out in this field. Yeah. Like they are not easy yeah. pickings like that. So, so tell us about the Leica, and well, tell us about what got you started bear hunting, and what was your decision or what was your thought process in getting the Leica for that?
Right. Well, I'll start from, I guess, let me start with, so I was born in Russia. Mm-hmm. I was 21 years old, I guess. Oh, yeah, so 20. Finished my university there, and kind of was time to move out of my parents' house. So I moved out, ended up here in the United States, and ended up staying here. You know, at that time, I just wanted to have fun and, right. you know. Then I get a credit card, and you get your first car loan, and next thing you know, you're pretty much...
You're hooked.
Yeah, you're hooked. You're not going anywhere. But I grew up in a hunting family, so that was one of the reasons I decided to stay here, was just driving down Route 7 up in Northern Virginia and seeing deer left and right everywhere. Like, oh, my God, I grew up in Russia, the middle of nowhere, and I didn't see that much wildlife
right.
in my entire life, although we went hunting a lot. And I always, again, growing up in a hunting family, it was my passion. So I stayed here. It took me a little while, several years, to get all the paperwork straight, became a citizen. First thing I did, I got my first gun. It was a side-by-side 12-gauge.
Oh, yeah?
Because that's what my dad used to hunt with. And started deer hunting, then got into bow hunting because I just wanted to extend the season. And with the archery early season, it was... logical step to start bow hunting. Then I, hunting in Virginia, we have three big game species, deer, turkey, and bear. I was harvesting deer, seeing turkeys, but I never saw bear. And I was like, what is this bear thing that's, it's always in the regulation books,
right.
but I never get to see one. And so then I started doing some research online, going to different forums back then. I guess Facebook was around, but I don't think the hunting groups were that popular in right. the beginning. But anyways, so just old school forums and asking questions and trying to do some research. I found out about places like Highland County, Augusta County, National Forest. Started going there looking for berries. That was probably 10 years ago.
Now, was this with or without bows?
Without. No. Again, I'm either bow hunting or at that time, I think I had 30-06 already. Uh-huh. So just firearm season, I use a gun. Bow season, I use a bow or crossbow. I kind of went back and forth between bow and crossbow and settled on a compound bow. Uh-huh. I started going out to Highland County National Forest there. Highland Wildlife Management Area. I would camp there December, try and find, I didn't have any friends hunting or anything like that. So looking for sign and just trying to figure it out. And then at some point, one day, I actually got to see a bear. It was a mother female with a uh-huh. cub. And I guess I, hiking for a while, sat down to take a rest and probably ate my sandwich or something and just look up and there's this bear 40 yards away and just moving through the, fallen trees and in December. So leaves on the ground, everything's crunchy, but that thing is so quiet. Mm-hmm. Like I was amazed. I knew it would be some really cool experience, but I didn't realize how cool it would be.
Right.
So that was my first experience with a bear. Then I, continued trying to get a bear and I just couldn't. I would go out and I'd try. And then I went to Alaska several times. Do-it-yourself type thing, same thing. Go there, buy the tag over the counter, and go looking for sign.
You just spotting, stalking.
Yeah, pretty much with my 30-06. And still nothing. And I made friends with some hunters in Alaska, and they allowed me to sit at their bait site. Mm-hmm. That's when I saw the first bear in Alaska. And at that time, I think it was my fourth or fifth trip to Alaska. And I was I was seriously starting to question if there's no bears in Alaska. It's still to lure in the tourists. But no, yeah, there are bears in Alaska. All right. And then since then, I went back to Alaska several times, but I never got a bear. I had my opportunities, but But still, so I came back to Virginia and I was like, okay, well, so what do I do? I tried hunting during archery season. I tried bait hunting in Alaska. We can't hunt, we cannot bait in Virginia, so that's not an option here. So I'm doing some more research, trying to find alternative ways of bear hunting, and I find such thing as hound hunting for bears. Mm-hmm. And so I do some research on that, and I'm like, okay, well, I live not far from D.C. I don't think I can have a pack of hounds. If I do, I don't think I'll be able to get, you know, train and exercise them enough, because where I live, we cannot chase bears with dogs. It's all private land, smaller parcels. Right. You know, it could be up to 40 acres and sometimes even more, but most of them are 5-10 acres. So that's not an option at all. And I'm talking all this time, I'm talking with some of my friends from back home. And some of them suggested, said, why don't you get a Leica? And now where I grew up in Russia hunting, it's all flatland. It's all agricultural fields. And we had no bears there. There's some deer and tons of small game and waterfowl. So that's what we hunt. So Leica, even though obviously I knew about it, I just never hunted with one because again, we didn't have any bears or anything, it was not popular in that region that I grew up in. And so I started researching that and figured, well, if they use Leicas to hunt brown bear in Russia, it should work on black bear. And back then there was a forum, actual forum here in the United States, Leica forum, I think it was. And I asked there and said, hey, anyone ever hunts black bear with Leica? Anyone had success? And a couple people said that they squirrel hunt and they treat bear occasionally, but not on purpose. And I said, well, that's a start. And so I went back to Russia and picked up two pups and brought them here. And that's how my journey began.
Started?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you didn't have a mentor. You didn't have anybody, like, teaching you, showing you?
No, I'm really shy and introverted.
Yeah?
Yes, I am.
But, I mean, you've picked this up on your own, and, you've done your research. You know, you've went to areas. So, tell us a little history about the Leica. You and I had talked about it earlier today. You know, give us some background on it, you know, what they were bred for, and tell us, you know, you have four of them. Tell us a little bit about your dogs, and then I want to know how you train these dogs without anybody and any help.
Right. Yeah, I'll tell you about that part of the journey. But, yeah, there are several different types of Leicas. I guess they're considered different breeds. But all the Leicas are what they call a primitive breed. So it's like, you know, to make a Labrador Retriever, they took two existing breeds. And they said, we want something from that breed that's already been established and from that breed. And they, cross them. Mm-hmm. And now we have a Labrador Retriever. And the same thing happened with most of the nowadays existing breeds. With Leicas, it was never like that. They took, I guess, a wolf way, way, way back when. Mm-hmm. Domesticated it, and it became a dog, right? So, and those dogs in remote villages of Siberia somewhere that were doing what their hunter master wanted them to do, basically hunt, those were fed, and those survived the winters. Those that did not hunt, they didn't survive. And that's how that breed was developed or established. I guess it developed on its own. Mm-hmm. Following the requirements of life back then,
right.
Conditions and circumstances. So that's why they call it a primitive breed, because it kind of developed on its own, so to speak. And so there are different regions in Siberia and across Russia in general, including the Scandinavian countries, mm-hmm. where this type of dog developed into a slightly different versions of it. So there are several types of Leicas or several types of primitive breeds. And so those, the ones I have are West Siberian Leica. Mm-hmm. They also have East Siberian Leica. They have the dog that's kind of known here, the black and white Karelian berry dog, elk hounds, mm-hmm. and Finnish Spitz. Mm-hmm. So they're all kind of sort of, if you look at them, they all have same characteristic. The tail is curled up, the ears are standing up, and they kind of look like a wolf or a coyote or fox.
Well, I was going to tell you, and I didn't want to interrupt you, but just looking at your dogs, their muzzle reminded me a lot of a coyote.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was more narrow and longer, and the teeth were very prominent.
Right.
Like, I picked that up when I looked at them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So and that's why when the season, actual hunting season starts, they have to wear orange vests. So, yeah, we don't go out during the hunting season without the vests on the dogs and right. some orange, obviously.
Where does the curled tail come from? Like, I told you my great-granddad had some elk hounds, mm-hmm. and they remind me of that. But where do we know, if they originated from the wolf,
right.
that is not a characteristic of the wolf.
Correct.
So where did that, what breed, what animal, or what dog got put into that to start doing that? And is there a purpose for the curled tail? Does it serve a purpose, or is that just a genetic thing for this breed?
So I don't really know, and I'm not sure. I don't think anyone really knows how it came to be. I do know that among a lot of hunters in Russia, although there are some people with a different opinion, but it's considered some people out there, they cross back to wolves uh-huh. to supposedly to add more strength or aggression or whatever. In reality, and that's what I hear from a lot of experienced hunters, it never ends up well, because again, with that extra strength, you also add extra aggression, or mm-hmm. dogs become more wary and afraid of humans. That's right. What the wolf blood adds to the mix.
I got a couple coyotes down here myself. They about as shy as a coyote.
Well, so the curled tail may have been an indication for a, let's say, again, we're talking several centuries ago, if not thousands of years ago. Let's say there's this hunting cabin somewhere, or some house in a village, and there's this family of hunters, and they have a litter of pups, and they keep them for several months to figure out which ones they're going to keep, and a couple of them have a tail that resembles a wolf's tail, and a couple could be due to certain degree of inbreeding at that early stage, or something else. I don't know. I'm just making stuff up, but it's possible that when they saw the tail curled up, in their minds, they're like, okay, well, this dog doesn't have the wolf features, so it'll be friendly. It will not attack my kids. It will not attack my, you know, cow outside or whatever. Uh-huh. And they kept the curly tail one, mm-hmm. hoping that it will not carry on the wolf side, wolf right. blood. So maybe that. But what I use it for, and what hunters like hunters use it for, it's basically it's an indicator of the dog's condition. So let's say it's getting hot, the dog is dehydrated, exhausted, the tail hangs low. Mm-hmm. They smell a bear, they smell some, whatever we're chasing, in my case a bear, a tail curls back up immediately.
It's like a flag for you.
Yeah, so it's an indicator. And I know, or if the dog is hurt, I might not show it, but I can tell that something is not right by looking at the tail.
By the way they carry
it. Yeah, and sometimes, sometimes it's been a long day and we're hiking, and I kind of see the dogs are not curling their tail up as much. And I'm like, and that's how they're telling me, okay, let's call it a day. Let's go home and recover, and we'll come back tomorrow. So that tail is also an indicator.
Right, yeah. So what were the Leica, and I know you said that they were originated for hunting, but where you got yours, what was the primary use for them?
Well, so hold that thought. I'll return to this question of yours. But there are certain, as I mentioned before, there are certain types of Leicas that were not strictly hunting dogs.
Oh, really?
And when I was sitting down to do my research, the reason I picked West Siberian Leicas was, again, this is the results of the research that I've done. I'm sure someone else might disagree with this, but which is fine. But the two alternatives coming out from Russia, in other words, the three most popular Laika breeds in Russia are West Siberian Laika, East Siberian, and they call it REL, which is Russo-European Laika, which is the same as Karelian Berry Dog, black and white. So the RELs, the black and whites, are known for slightly more aggressive towards other dogs, which could be a benefit when we're talking bear hunting. But again, I don't want any aggression, excessive aggression, unnecessary aggression towards other dogs. Mm-hmm. And also the KBDs and those dogs, they're kind of known for seizures. Mm. Doesn't happen often, but it's every now and again, those dogs, they experience that.
So that's a genetic trait that they pass.
So whenever they separated that black and white, because initially they all came from the same stock, and they just, they kind of got involved and they say, okay, we're going to make out of this whole pool of genes, we're going to pick out the black and white ones, and we're going to make it a separate breed. When they narrowed down the gene pool, I think that's where those genetic seizure problems may have come in. So that kind of was a deal breaker for me. The East Siberian Laikas are larger, and they're used 50-50 hunting and sled pulling out that way. They're larger dogs. You saw my male. He is kind of longer.
He's longer and taller.
Yeah, but those are even larger on average. Now, just like with people, some could be shorter, some can be taller. But on average, they're slightly larger, which at that time, I've done some research. Well, first of all, it's a 50% sled dog, 50% hunt dog, which I'm not into sledding at all.
Right.
So I was like, well, I guess that's not what I'm looking for. And another thing is I've been told by multiple hunters here that they prefer a smaller dog for this setting, for the mountains, Appalachian mountains. And so the third option was the West Siberian Laikas. They're probably most common. That means that their genes are as diverse as it can be. Health problems are virtually non-existent. They're very easy, maintenance-free dogs. Mm-hmm. And that's how I chose those. And I promised to go back to your question. Sure enough, I forgot your question. about my dogs, how I picked my dogs. Okay, so I have some friends back in Russia that hunt Laikas for moose and for sable. Sable, it's kind of like, I guess, maybe like fisher here.
So it's of a cat species.
Well, they're not. Fisher cat is not a cat. It's more like a, I guess, weasel maybe or wolverine type thing, but they're just smaller. But they're not cat. They call them fisher cat. But whatever. So it's basically, I was looking for a dog that would tree something and stay treed. But I needed that something to be slightly larger than a squirrel because obviously a squirrel cannot fight back, you know.
Right.
So when I was reaching out to different breeders in Russia and some of my friends, I was telling them, look, I need a bear dog, but the bear dog, such bear dog that would actually tree, not just bay on the ground, because that's what brown bears do. They don't really climb.
Right.
They bay them on the ground. So it was a kind of, you know, odd, weird request to find a Laika that will be a bear dog, but at the same time will be a tree dog.
Right.
And in my mind, and you know, everybody was coming up with different suggestions. People saying, well, just get a moose Laika or a boar Laika, because boars can, you know, cause some damage. So you need a Laika with a very strong mental strength, mentally strong. And I decided to get a dog from what they call like a big game line, so moose, boar, that had close relatives or parents with sable diplomas or sable hunting experience. Sable is basically, I don't know how big they get, maybe 15 pounds or so, but they tree, and so the dog has to stay treed till the hunter gets there and shoots it out. So, yeah, it's not, the sable is not as big as a bear, but if it has some big game blood in it, and it can tree well, stay treed, that's what I want. And then from there, I'll show it black bear at some point, and either they're going to figure out or not. Mm-hmm. And that's how my journey with Laika started. And this is where we're coming to your question, how I trained them.
Hold on, I got to go back.
Okay.
You said that they had to have a sable, either diploma or...
Yes.
So a couple weeks ago, I had Ken Parker, who had the Bavarian Hound from Germany.
Yep.
And he was talking about the breeding process, and they had to meet a certain standard, and that if they didn't meet that standard, they didn't get registered, and they didn't get bred.
And you can't breed them,
So you're telling me the same thing with yours.
Right, yeah, so on the spectrum of kind of loose breeding rules, which we see here in this country, and extremely strict, which we see in Germany, Russia is kind of in the middle. So, yes, we have certain... tests in place. However, not everyone, follows them. But people that are interested in hunting, they will ask for those certificates and see what the dog's parents did, what the parents of the parents, and so on.
Right.
So, like my dogs, if you look at their pedigree, it has a whole bunch of different, besides the names of the sire and then their grandparents and so on, it has a tons and ton of different symbols, numbers and letters and just abbreviations, and those all those symbols are codes for different game species that those dogs were tested, and then what degree of diploma they obtained. So when you look at all that, you can kind of figure out with some certainty what you're going to end up with.
Well, your chances are a whole lot better from something that's proven.
I believe so, yes.
I mean, I know we won't get off topic, but I think we Americans, and especially the hound hunters, we got to do better. You know, we can't be breeding Sally to Joe back here just because we're buddies. We're not producing the optimal hound that we want. But anyway... So good. When you said that, I was like, okay, here we go. So
yeah, it's important if you really care about it. If you're getting into this long term, if you really want to be successful, I think it's no brainer.
Yeah. I wished we had tests that we could take our dogs out and say, okay, this is a bear dog under these standards, and this is not a bear dog under these standards. But
well, I hear that back in the day you could do it legally in the United States where you had a bear on the chain. And you could test dogs on that. I don't think you can do it no more.
The Humane Society of America slipped in and took that away. So.
Well, they still do it in Russia. And before the whole thing started in Europe, Eastern European hunters, they would take their Laikas, which were initially imported from Russia, they would take them back to Russia and test them on bear. Because again, somewhere in Poland, it's also not highly illegal to train on to test on a bear like that on a chain. But they would take them to Russia, get the diplomas, translate them, notarize them and whatnot, bring them back, have puppies, and sell those puppies for more money because the parents are proven bear dogs. So they can still do it legally. It's been under attack, obviously, over there as well.
Right.
But so far, there's still ways to do it. Now, my dogs, I never introduced them to a live bear. They treat their first bear on their own.
Well, okay, so that was my next question. Tell me about your four dogs. I know you got one that you're not hunting now, but I want to know why. Tell us the age. Tell us, where they're at in the pack, how they work, and then we'll get into to how they operate.
Right. So I'll start with my first two dogs that I brought over close to 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago. They're about 4 years now. I mean, I guess I need to look at my records, but they're not quite 4 years ago, 4 years old. So I brought them here about 3.5 years ago, still as pups. So again, I got them based on a recommendation of my good friend who hunts the same bloodline. In fact, they're pretty close relatives, his dogs and mine. Mine is just a little younger. And he hunts on moose, and so that tells me that they're not afraid of large, big game that can charge sometimes and can even, cause some damage. And the dog is mentally strong to overcome it, recover, and continue hunting. That was important for me. So I got the pups, and... again, let's go back to what I was saying in the beginning. I was really passionate. I wanted to see a bear as a third game species in Virginia, a big game species. And I wanted to, you know, to harvest one. And I just couldn't. And I kept trying. And then I go fly back to Russia, bring those two pups. They're still 4 months old. Mm-hmm. And it happens to be, or maybe 6 months, whatever. And then October, archery bear season starts. And I'm sitting out there for, and it correlates with deer season. So I'm sitting there with my bow while my pups are at home. They're 5-6 months old. And I'm waiting for a deer, and a bear shows up. And he comes right to my tree stand, like 7-8 yards maybe. Mm-hmm. So I shoot him with my bow, and I bring it home. I put it in the wheelbarrow. It was a relatively small, like 150-pound bear. Mm-hmm. So I got it there, and I put it on my shoulders and brought it back to my truck, drove home, put it in the wheelbarrow, wheel it over to my dogs in the backyard, and they just go crazy. They start barking like crazy. I mean, 5-6 months old pups. Mm-hmm. At first, they kind of pulled back a little bit, not sure what it was, but then I kind of shake the wheelbarrow. I don't know if you're going to... He might have to cut it out.
No.
Because here I am in my backyard with a dead bear. Which, by the way, again, I went to Russia, brought this bear dogs in hopes that finally this is how I'm going to get my first bear. And then I go deer hunting and it just happens to walk by.
Yeah.
So anyways, that's where their first and only...
Training experience.
Yeah. Everybody that I talked to, I explained them the situation. I said, I can't take them to a chain bear. It's just not an option. They said, well, just work on their confidence. The more time, this is what they told me, and this is what I'm from after that, what they told me did work. This is what I'm telling everyone who wants to get into the like is you got to build their confidence, and you got to, and you do it through spending a lot of time in the woods with them and letting them figure it out on their own.
Right.
So I just started. So first thing I worked on was the command to recall, come. As soon as I knew that they would come and I got my first garments, mm-hmm. I put the garments on, I did the beep thing, which again, with these dogs, they're so mentally stable. Like they were never gun shy. And that's how most Laikas are. I guess well-bred, like I should say, probably. Fireworks, like I have a lab. Uh-huh. She's 9 and a half. And then, although we hunt, goose hunt, and we do pheasant hunt in Pennsylvania, it's a hunting scenario, she has no problem with guns going off, no problem. Fireworks, I'm talking about my lab. Mm-hmm. Fireworks, thunder, she's just freaking out. This Laikas, they don't care. Fireworks, they're looking around where they're looking up at the trees, thinking the bear is about to fall out, you know. So they're from the little tiny, from when they're small. So that mental strength was never a problem with these dogs. I got the garments to make sure I don't lose them, and I got the recall command come, you know, kind of working 75% of the time.
Right.
They're still small, 6 months. I start taking them in the woods. First, they wouldn't leave me. They would stay, you know, they in sight with me 50 yards tops, sometimes less because of brush, whatever. They would venture out a little bit, 50, 100 yards. They always come back, check on me. Little tiny pups. The first thing they treed, well, they bayed technically, I guess the right word is bayed. They were probably 7 months, and it happened way up on the mountain, I don't know, probably like 200 feet elevation. But it was one of those mountains that you, by the time you get there, you're like, okay, you're exhausted. Yeah. But it was a turtle, one of those box turtles, I guess. I don't know. But they were 7 months old pups, and they were just baying, like, for real, like, you know, some mean bear or something. They're, you know, getting in close enough. At that time, I could see how, everybody's talking how to get two Laikas, because when you see two Laikas working one bear, it'll be some... You know, it'll be an art, because what they do, they take turns. One dog engages, the bear turns, that dog backs off, and when the bear is paying attention to the first dog, the second dog on the opposite side engages the bear, and that's how they wear it out till the bear says, "I'm just gonna either." If it's a brown bear, it might sit down and just kind of stay there, so they keep them in one spot so the hunter can approach for a shot. Or if it's a black bear, it just gives up and climbs a tree. But that's what they were doing on that little turtle. So I climbed up and I see that turtle, I wasn't mad because that was part of the process. I knew I'm going to raccoon hunt with them. So I was taking them out at night because that's something that fortunately we can do all year round here in Virginia. I never showed them, any coon hides or anything like that. At that time, I didn't have any friends in coon hunting. I didn't know anything about trapping. I still don't really know much about trapping. So I started taking them out in the woods. So that time spent in the woods allows them to build confidence and figure out what's going on. And that tree and chasing game and tree and instinct is within them, I guess, genetically. And they just need to gain enough confidence, and they will first bait a turtle, then they'll tree a squirrel, then they'll tree a possum, then a raccoon, and then the next step would be a bear. Mm-hmm. That's what I've been told, and that's exactly how it played out. At about probably seven, 8 months old, they were treeing a lot of possums. 10 months, 1 year, they were started treeing raccoons. Mm-hmm. Never showed them any raccoons or anything. They just treeing them, obviously, for me to encourage them to continue treeing that particular game. I would shoot it out, mm-hmm. and I would praise them. Next time they tree a possum, that's not on the menu anymore for me. I've eaten a lot of possums by that point, which I still like them, but I was done with possums because of the dogs. I wanted them to progress to raccoons. So I told them, we're going to leave them alone now, and I stopped shooting them. Uh-huh. Eventually, they stopped treeing them. So now it was raccoons only. And then next thing, they were about 1.5 years old and were just out in the woods, and all of a sudden they start treeing not far from where I was. I go up there, and it's a bear. Mm. And that was it, you know.
So basically, like I said, I know you and I kind of touched on it earlier. We want to talk about the style, but basically you just walking in the woods, yep. and, you know, basically they happened up on one, or you rabbit jumped it, whichever way, and the dogs have enough gaminess mm-hmm. that they're going to catch it
right.
and either bay it or tree it.
Right. And I'm sure now that I have two younger dogs, and now that I can tell what my older dogs, I've had enough experience with the older dogs, and I know by looking at the Garmin, I know what they're chasing. Now that I see that my 9-10 months old pups, they would be chasing a bear, but they would leave it and they wouldn't bark and they wouldn't pressure it much. In other words, they would not engage it because they don't feel confident. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure, because in the beginning I had tons of races that were like 300 yards, and then my dogs just stop and come back. And mind you, that's one thing I guess I should have mentioned. The only training I did was breaking them off of deer. Mm-hmm. And I did use the Garmin with the stimulation.
Right.
And it worked fine. But I also use a lot of verbal commands with them. Mm-hmm. And it seems to work just fine. You know, so but that's when I see a deer, when they jump a deer and they take off, and I would just yell at them and they come back. Maybe 2-3 times I used the Garmin collar, the stimulation for that, but mostly it was verbal, and eventually they stopped. But what I'm saying is, when my older dogs, when I was still learning all this, when they were still learning from like 1 year to 1.5, when they first treed their bear, in those 6 months, we had multiple chases that ended within 300-400 yards. And I was like, I wonder what they're chasing. Uh-huh. Now I'm looking at the young pups when we go out with the older ones. And I see the same pattern, and I see that the younger ones are chasing the bear, but they're just not confident enough to engage and tree it, and they give up. And it happened a couple times now where they kind of chased. The older dogs were on the other side of the ridge, and it just happened that they chased the bear towards the older ones, and they treed it. So I'm with confidence I can say that my dogs, older dogs, until they gained confidence, they were chasing, they were finding bears, mm-hmm. they were interested in it, but they were not confident enough, and they wouldn't engage, and they wouldn't tree. And only when they got to 1.5 years old, when they treed first one, it was still early, kind of like probably late September. And then that first December, when the season opened, we went out several times, and then finally we treed one, and I shot it, and that pretty much sealed the deal.
Right.
And ever since, they they knew that that's what's our object, you know, that's our, what we're after.
Right. So you and I were talking earlier. So you had your older female, you said, is the alpha.
Well, they're sisters, but the one of them is the alpha, just yeah. like with any, you know, pack that you'd have.
Right.
And this is interesting. And this, again, this is something that, I guess this probably should be a different podcast, and I'm hoping maybe that's been discussed, but I kind of going to mention it, maybe you, to hear your input. But with Leicas, one of the things that's valued is the range, like how far they range out uh-huh. from a hunter. Because most of the time they would stay within 300 yards, sometimes 300 yards. Occasionally they go out 500 yards. Typically in my case, if my dogs are going off 500 plus, that means they're chasing something.
Right.
They usually stay close. Now, some dogs venture out farther, others stay closer. I've noticed that my alpha stays closer. Mm-hmm. The second dog, and this is how I wanted to see hear your opinion. I think it's okay. So and people would say, well, this dog has a larger range because that it genetically has larger, wider mm-hmm. range, and I kind of disagree with that. I think it's not so much because they're sisters, so mm-hmm. technically genes would probably be very similar, litter mates. I think it's psychological. So here we have the alpha, and here we have the second dog that's more, you know, so let's say I give them food, I give them bones, and then they chew on those bones, and I kind of forget about them, and I walk, or I'm at work, and I know that at some point the alpha would come over and take the bone mm-hmm. from the other dog. So this, if we tree a coon and I shoot it out, the butcher, the alpha, that's the alpha's name, mm-hmm. she claims that coon. Mm-hmm. And if the second dog tries to approach it, she growls at her. Now, I don't encourage that, or in fact, I tell her, you know, to behave and not, I don't encourage that behavior, but right. still, she's the alpha and she'll do it. And I can't be there 24/7 with them, so occasionally she does what alphas do. And so this is the scenario that I see with my dogs, and I wonder if the same thing is happening with hounds, where the alpha just stays closer to me, and the second dog is thinking, okay, well, if I tree something here, she's going to come over and she's going to take over. She's going to claim that whatever, you know, I find. So I'm going to go off half a mile or further out and try to find and tree something for myself instead of staying here close to the alpha. And so she goes off on her own. And so someone else looking at this says, well, that dog has a wide range. Mm-hmm. And I say they both have the same range. It's just that dog is not the alpha, and she wants to get away from the alpha and go hunting something that the alpha will not claim. That's how I see it. Because sometimes my alpha, if I take her by herself, sometimes she'd venture out. And on top of that, every now and again, let's say we're following the ridge top, and my alpha is next to me, and the other dog goes way down the holler to a creek or something. That alpha would stand there and look and listen down below, waiting for that second dog to bark. And as soon as she barks, then she runs. If that dog doesn't bark and comes back, then we continue on following the ridge top. But this alpha, she won't waste any energy mm-hmm. For nothing. She knows that dog is out there somewhere, and if she barks, then she'll go and, you know, start treeing with her. Anyways,
I don't know. I can see that. I can see that what you're saying. I can see a dog, especially knowing the pack order of a dog getting away. And I can see the other side of it because I have dogs that are in the middle of the pack that uh-huh. hunt different ranges. So I don't know. I don't know that I could give you a...
But in your pack, and I know you also free cast a mm-hmm. lot, do you know which one is the alpha? Can you tell? Or it changes? Do they challenge each other?
No. Mine are pretty... Probably pretty even keel.
So you are the alpha then, I guess.
Well, I mean, technically maybe. My little female, Kate, she's the one that does more posturing. Mm-hmm. She don't put up with no... And she's not mean or nothing like that by no means, but like the younger dogs, if they get to playing and being silly, mm-hmm. boom, mm-hmm. she postures at them, and she'll give them that head tilt, mm-hmm. and they go and leave her alone. So I know that she's showing that,
right,
you know, that alpha part.
So when you go out hunting, does she tend to range out wider, or she tends to stay closer?
No, she actually slips out on me more so. She'll like I said, if she's getting past that 400 mark, I need to watch, because she's getting ready to bust out of there.
Meaning that she's chasing something.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, right. Yeah. But not like in search mode.
No, well, all of my dogs, but I've trained them.
Mm.
Like, I want my dogs within a 300-yard circle.
Mm-hmm.
Because just like the terrain you're hunting, I mean, sometimes they pop over, holler over, they could be opening in there and doing whatever, the dogs can't hear them.
Mm-hmm.
So I like my dogs in that kind of that circumference. I like that. You know, if they range out an extra 100 yards or so, I don't say too much, but I'm watching. And again, I usually have my older dogs loose and my younger dogs on a lead or something. Or
right.
I don't lead them, but I put them on a double coupler together and they walk with me.
Yeah, it's entirely different, entirely different dynamic. Yeah. And I've hunted with hounds some, but I don't have enough experience to compare. And I don't need to compare. It's just a different hunting style.
But I want to do, Leah, I do want to compare a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
My experience with the elk hound, which is kind of, you know, what we see, they're tight. They're tight mouth.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about 300, 400, 500, 600-yard races. Is that because the dogs are pretty much silent until they catch?
Mm-hmm.
And then once they catch, it's like, bam, I got you. You're either going to set, we're going to either bay you or you're going up a tree.
Right.
Do you think that's
the... Yeah. So the surprise part of it is probably the most important thing that works in the dog's favor.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing is they do engage some. Again, if the terrain and the thickness of the cover allows for maneuvering, which, again, I've been lucky enough to observe where on the opposite side of a holler, I could see the dogs working the bear, and that's what they were doing. And one engages or gets close enough for the bear to pay more attention to this dog, and that's at the same time when the bear turned its back on the other dog, the dog bites it on its hind legs. And bears obviously don't like that, and then eventually they'll climb. Or if it's a bigger bear, which we experienced earlier this training season, they just kind of get their butt in some real thick stuff.
Yeah, they'll set back on it where they can.
Yeah, and they just face the dogs, and dogs are barking, and every now and again they kind of bluff charge, and they go back into that corner where they find, you know, they feel more or less safe because
they don't like their back end fooled with. So, I mean, we've seen this multiple times with dogs, you know, backing up, like I said, in a rock outcrop or backing in a thick laurel bush,
right?
Something to keep their hind end from being exposed. And you know, when you was talking to me about that earlier, I really thought it just screamed intelligence, like a dog that knows to not get the front end.
It could be that, but also going back to those testing. Mm-hmm. Trials, I guess.
Right.
They do in Russia. They give you certain points for. They give you 3 degrees, different degrees of diplomas, like first, second, and third degree.
Uh-huh.
In order, they rate you or your dogs for different things, and certain actions deserve more points.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, if your Laika engages with a bear into its front face or front shoulders, paws, it's a no-no, because that means that Laika is really in danger, because that bear can easily get to it.
Right.
And if it engages from the back, that's extra points. So the dogs that have extra points for doing that type of engaging from behind where it's safe, those tend to get, you know, first degree diplomas, and those would be, you know, the prime candidates for breeding.
Right.
So maybe it's intelligence in them, because they don't want to get hurt, and they kind of figure out, if I engage from behind, especially if it's a pair of dogs, or maybe it's been bred into them to a degree where It's a preferred method of hunting and engaging a bear from behind. So those dogs, or maybe again, those dogs that engage from the front, they don't survive.
No.
And that they don't obviously don't get bred as a result of not surviving. Right. So maybe it's a combination of all those things. But yeah, the bottom line is a Leica should not engage face-to-face. It'll go from the back.
Right.
Which is much safer and as efficient.
So let's talk about the nose a little bit. So I know you had told me earlier. So since they're basically silent on a track, talk to me a little bit and tell the listeners, you know, what your experience has been so far, what you told me earlier about, you know, some time periods.
Yeah.
And then, you know, what people say in Russia about the nose.
Right. I don't even know where to start. There's tons of information.
Let's put the environmental factors out. We all know that in hot, humid conditions, I don't care what you're hunting, but your track time decreases tremendously.
Oh yeah, they can be trailing. My dogs can be trailing something up the mountain. As soon as they get on the ridge top where it's just rocks and it's super windy, that's where they lose it.
Mm-hmm.
So they can certainly do some ground scent trailing.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing, they cross whatever they're chasing across the creek. That confuses my dogs. They're getting better at it, but still.
So the water crossings is confusing them?
Yeah. Again, I don't know. I'm not always there. Sometimes I just see it on the Garmin screen. Uh-huh. I've seen a bobcat jump a creek,
mm-hmm.
and they couldn't figure it out. Maybe it jumped some rock and then jumped diagonally or something. I don't know. But that doesn't happen as often as the one that it's like on a windy day. If it's a saddle with tons of, like, you know, open saddle, so mm-hmm. to speak, the rocks are just bare ground, and if it's super windy, chances are we're going to lose whatever we're chasing once they get to the top of the saddle, top of the ridge, where the wind is just blowing that scent off of the top.
But
of
this,
the ridge.
But they're not jumped at this point. They're not looking at it.
No,
This is when your dogs are trying to work the odor out.
Correct, yes.
And even though they are tight, and I don't want to call them silent or tight-lipped, whatever you say they are, you know, you told me that, you know, you've seen on trail camera
mm-hmm.
that a bear crossed and you went back and you were able to, the dogs worked the ground. And
right. So that was one instance. Again, I've heard stories from other hunters with Leicas and hound hunters and hunters in general that you listen to that story and you're thinking, either I'm such a bad hunter or my dogs are so bad, but I don't think it's ever even possible that we'll come anywhere close to what you're describing. Like your dogs have some sixth sense or something. Mm-hmm. And so, and you know, you just hear those stories and at some point you're starting to question that source of information.
Right.
And so I tend to rely on more or less facts that can be proven.
Right.
So for instance, I come home. Well, it was last August chase season. I come home, it was like 6 p.m. maybe, and I have a trail camera set up 45 minutes. No, yeah, it was 45 minutes away. I jump in and I get a picture. As I'm pulling in my driveway, I get a picture of a bear in front of that trail camera.
Mm-hmm.
I turn around. I put the dogs in the box. I throw the box in, put the dogs in, drive there as fast as I can. 45 minutes later, I put the dogs there in front of the camera, and then several minutes later, they start baying that bear, I don't know, maybe like a couple hundred yards away, 300 yards away. It was a big bear, so he couldn't climb. I guess he didn't want to climb, or he couldn't climb, but I was able to get to 30 yards or so. So that was my first confirmed age of a trek that they could take it. And it was not like they, because at that time I went back to the trail camera where that started when I called the dogs back and called them off. I said, maybe they winded it.
Mm-hmm.
I went back to the trail camera, I checked the wind. It was not coming from that direction.
Mm-hmm.
So they used ground scent to chase that bear. So 45 minute old trek in my mind was a confirmed 45 minute. That's what they're capable of. And this August, I was out during chase season, beginning of chase season, and the dogs chased something. Maybe it was a bobcat. It was not a bear. Eventually, they split. They lost it. One of the dogs kind of went one way. The other dogs came back to me. Then we continued on And my dogs, I've never lost them. If it happens that they can't find me, they usually figure out the way to find me. If they can't, they just backtrack to the truck and they sit at the truck and wait for me. Mm-hmm. So that one dog that did not return, I could see her on the other side of the mountain with a telescopic antenna for the Garmin I use. And she's just still trying to figure something out. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to continue hunting, and she'll either come back to me or she'll go back to the truck. So we went on. Every now and again, I'd check on her, make sure she was fine. At some point, I found some old apple orchard. I made a waypoint. Let's say it was whatever, I don't know, noon. And then that dog is still on the opposite side of a mountain trying, I don't know what she's doing there. Maybe she laid down because it was hot. Maybe she found something to drink and cool off. 2 hours later, I left that orchard. Continued on. 2 hours later, that dog came back over the mountain, came down, happened to cross where I walked just outside that apple orchard. So that was 2 hours ago that I was there. Because again, I remember because I made a waypoint. Mm-hmm. And she picked up my scent and she followed me and she caught up with me. And I wasn't following a trail, I was just bushwhacking following reach tops and then just going like diagonally going down mountainside. So there was no trails, maybe some game trails here and there, but it's not like I was walking a trail. So that dog followed my tracks, my scent that was left 2 hours ago. So that's the second instance where I can say that these dogs are capable of a 2 hour old track. Mm-hmm. Now, is it a lot? Probably not. But if we go out hunting and we cover 6 miles in the mountains or 10 miles, chances are, especially if we do it early morning or late in the afternoon, chances are we're going to run into a bear track that's within those 2 hours frame. And that's even considering that 2 hours is their limit. Chances are, if conditions are right, it could be longer. And the dogs, as they get more and more experienced, they're probably capable of picking up and figuring out and following a track that's even older. But this is, in a nutshell, how our hunts play out. We just start hunting. I look on X or whatever map you use. I look on the map. I figure out the spot that's the most remote from any roads because that's where hound hunters will rig everything in the morning.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, I'm not going anywhere close to vehicle access. I'll try to go where there's no hikers or not many hikers. Although I'm not sure that affects bears as much as hounds. And ideally, I would know what bears are eating at that time, and I will try to target that. And that's what I do. And I start hiking, and it's quiet, and we go. And I always, if I bring someone along, I tell them, we'll just be quiet. Once the bear is in a tree, we can talk as much as we want. And after the hunt's done, we'll discuss, we'll catch up on everything. But for now, let's just be quiet and stealthy, and we'll just start hiking, and we hike. At some point, all of a sudden, the dogs just start barking, and 100, 200, 300 yards, they're treed. Mm-hmm. And we go in, and it's a bear. So it's not for everyone. It's quiet. Maybe it's boring, but when it happens quick, and it's typically a bear.
And you say it's not for everyone, but the end game is to catch bears.
Well, for me it is.
Right.
But I hear people talking, again, as I said before, I'm kind of introverted. Uh-huh. I like talking about hunting, but that's about it. Maybe that's the only thing that's on my mind. But I hear people say, oh, for me it's important to catch up with my buddies, so the social aspect of it is important, which I can clearly see how it's important for most people, maybe some most people. I'm just not like that. My goal is to see that bear in the tree, and not to mention that they taste good when the season is open. So this style of hunting, you can't just, socialize and talk out loud and laugh and, stuff like that.
Right.
Just, you can when the job's done, but up to that, it's all business. You got to be quiet. The dogs are quiet. We're going in, we find that bear, then we can do whatever we want.
And I, I'm sitting here listening to you, and I'm thinking back through many hunts that I've been on. Like, I can't tell you, over the 25, 7, 8 years, whatever I've been doing this, I mean, I can't count on both hands how many times I've been walking through the woods, just the dog's loose, and the next thing you know, they're bayed or treed. Mm-hmm. It's just automatic. Mm-hmm. And that element of surprise, you know, the dog's obviously run right up on it in its bed and jumped it right up a tree.
Right.
And I mean, most of the time when that happens, like, it's treed immediately.
Right.
I mean, you just, I can't recall right off the top of my head right now any time that they've done that and run for miles. You know, most of those times that I've been, well, all of them have been just like what you're talking about. You know, you hear the roar and they're treed.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, that you hear the roar and they're caught and it don't go nowhere. So I think, you know, the dog's being tight on the ground and putting, you know, they let you know when they're caught. They just completely surprise a bear.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's the element of surprise.
Yeah, and in my case, most of the time, as I said, my alpha stays close to me. The second dog ventures out. If, let's say, that dog jumps the bear and trees the bear by herself. Most mm-hmm. of the time, the bear is treed by one dog. When the dog starts barking, when the bear is treed, the second dog joins in, and then both of them start barking. It's not seldom, but like maybe 35-40% of the time is when both dogs happen to be in the same spot and they start to chase, mm-hmm. or they jump the bear at the same time. Typically, they're not together. So typically, it's one dog that actually surprises mm-hmm. and trees the bear. The second dog, again, if that bear is on the ground, that's when the second dog joins in, and that's when they start their dance thing, and that's what helps treat or keep it at bay. But yes, that element of surprise, even with one dog,
mm-hmm.
can still work, and it works. Again, in my case, we start out hiking quiet. They find it. It happens quick. Then with two dogs at the tree, barking at the bear under the tree, then I approach if I have another friend of mine or hunter with me.
Wait a second, how do they keep up with you? I hear that you're a complete terror in the woods.
No, that's not true.
Oh, that's what I hear.
I'm 6'6", and my legs are, I don't know how many.
You got the long legs. Well, so.
No, but that's not true. I go slow. Because typically, and that's another thing, I try to carry water for my dogs. So I would mm-hmm. have like a gallon at least in my backpack. And also in my pack, I have pliers because we're, you know, occasionally would run into a porcupine, mm-hmm. typically further north.
Yeah.
I don't think you have them here.
No.
But they're coming. I mean, we see them in Clark County, Virginia.
Really?
We see them on the side of a road. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Now, for the past couple of years. So they're coming down from Pennsylvania and northern West Virginia. Anyways, pliers, extra antenna, leashes, you know, the kill kit, whatever else I carry with me. So my pack is pretty, and of course, a gallon of water, plus some water for myself, plus lunch and whatever. It kind of in the gun if it's the season. So my pack is kind of heavy to begin with.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not trying to kill myself. I go slow. And in fact, sometimes it's good for me to slow down, stop, and let the dogs go to the left, and maybe go over the ridge, explore mm-hmm. that area on the other side of the mountain. So I don't go fast.
Now, I don't know. That's not what Taylor and Ariel said. They said that.
Well, when the dogs are treed, then I just go. I don't know. that gives me some motivation. But that's basically the hunt in a nutshell. We just start going. They tree. It happens typically most of the time. It happens quick, and then we get there. And this is where the first thing, you know, if things can go wrong, this typically, at least where it used to go wrong when I had two dogs. Now that I have another one, I have four, but one of them is a squirrel dog. So now I run with three dogs, and all three of them, it makes it a little easier. And what I'm talking about bears bailing out of trees.
Yep.
Because it's only two dogs. It's not a pack of hounds. The bear is up there, and he's like, should I run or should I stay? It's only two dogs, but they were kind of biting me, so it didn't feel that great. But then humans show up,
uh-huh.
and that's when bears like, okay, we're out of here. And that happens several times. Typically, though, they're treed again within 100 yards or so. Mm-hmm. And I have tons of video on TikTok. Unfortunately, it was banned, so you all can't see it. But it's on Instagram, too. But you can see where I approach a tree. The bear looks at me, jumps out, and I'm filming this. And then less than 100 yards, he's back treed because dogs are on him right away. Now with three dogs, it's a little seems like it's a little easier. Mm-hmm. Maybe I learn how to approach that, because that's an art in itself. Because you know the wind. I try to find a tree in between the bear and myself, and I try to get as close as I can to that bear. Because once you get to like 20 yards, the bear considers you part of a pack, and he's not. If he sees you 50 yards away or so, he's going to try to bail. Once you get under that tree, he's not going to, in my experience.
Yeah, it's not as, yeah.
The trick is to get under the tree as fast as I can before the bear, you know, has time to see me and decide to bail.
Yeah, I mean, we have the same issues, and I don't know. Sometimes I just don't understand it. I don't understand why an 80-pound bear won't tree, and, you know, and you've got five or six hounds working him over, and then sometimes you've got a 250-pound bear that goes up first tree. I don't understand right. it. I guess I never will.
Well, there are a lot of things to it, and I'm still trying to figure it out. But I didn't notice that the type of a tree they chose probably plays the biggest role. If the bear is comfortable, if it's tall enough, and there's branches comfortable, he'll stay. Another thing, this is the question. In fact, Ariel and I were talking about this not long ago. How does treeing and freeing bears? How does that? Does it train them to run, or does it train them to tree faster? So we had a bear in West Virginia early season, a small bear that we treed, and we let him go. And he treed like within 150 yards. Quick. Second day, we went to the same drainage, same holler, and we jumped in the same area. And I'm convinced we jumped the same bear because there was tons of food. He was eating at pawpaws, I guess, autumn olive. Mm-hmm. He ran. It was the young dog that treed him, according to the GPS. I'm looking. He barked several times. Then they stop. He starts barking. Then the one of the older dogs had happened to be nearby, joins the young dog under the tree, and that's when the bear bails. So I'm thinking it's the same bear that was treed night before or day before. And when he saw the second dog coming, he's like, oh, I've been through this before. Next, and more dogs, and then the humans will show up.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're going to point a finger at me. They're going to put me on Instagram. I better go. And I think that's exactly what happened. So as soon as the second dog showed up, he's like, okay, I'm out of here because I've been through this. So maybe it's doing that. Maybe not.
Ariel and I had touched on that, you know, the classical conditioning, the operant conditioning. Mm-hmm. I have my own thoughts and things that what I think, but... I get a bear treat. I prefer just to get my dogs and get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And Aaron and I had talked about some scenarios that I'd seen through what I'd learned through experience. But yeah, I think it plays a part in it, especially if you're treeing the same bear.
If
you hunt the same area, you're going to catch the same bear a couple times. I'd love to be able to put cow tags in them.
Yeah.
That way I could know. This one's somehow green. This one's orange. Yeah.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that we treat the same bear when we don't want to, and when you want to treat that same bear that you treat during the chase season and the kill season starts, and you like, I have two bears that I've seen, bigger ones, and I don't think I'll see him again in December, but I'll try. But it's
just 30 days next week.
Yeah, yeah. There's a chance. Yeah, there's a chance.
There you go.
Yeah.
So, let's wrap this up. And, you know, what you're telling me about the Leicas, I looked at your dogs. They're medium sized. They're good sized. I like their size. One of the questions I had is, how does the heat affect them with that heavy coat?
I don't have much experience with hounds. I did have a hound. I shipped him to Russia at some point for a friend. I started him on bear. He was, you know, starting his own trek. He was progressing real great. But every time if we hunt 3 days in a row, his pads were peeling.
White pads? Or are they black?
I didn't really pay attention.
I guarantee you they're white and pink.
Could be.
Yep.
Yeah. So those dogs never had that problem.
Mm-hmm.
With heat, again, it was during that season, it was last early season that the hound and my Leicas were, you know, running together. Mm-hmm. They seemed to be doing just fine, the same. Again, we try that's another thing. When I plan out my route, I kind of try to have a couple creek crossings in between so they can cool down. So I incorporate that in our hunt plan if it's possible.
So do you think, and I was thinking about this. Do you think because your dogs aren't like trailing and running, you know, like today, I mean, I guess my dogs covered, I would say they covered probably 10 miles running.
Yeah.
They come out of the south, crossed over into the north, run out the north for a couple miles, then down off the mountain, back up the mountain. Do you think because your races are so short, so quick,
right,
that you're not getting to that exhaustion level that maybe we are?
Correct. And another thing is, and this is what happened this morning, the dogs chased that bear for about 800 yards, mm-hmm, and they gave up. And this is what I was listening to your podcast, Dr. Hall.
Dr. Hall, Nathan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about how dogs, when they don't find, he was talking about explosive, mm-hmm, detection. If they don't see it for a couple of weeks in a row, they kind of give up on doing that. So they lose interest or motivation to do that job. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's a similar concept. My dogs, when I see them, if they can't catch that bear within 500-600 yards, mm-hmm, and it's like running full speed, typically younger bear,
yes,
I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Because on an older bear, those can move on rare occasions. They can also move for a long time, but it's always much slower.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, so my dogs, and this has happened, it typically happens early season, and it doesn't happen often, but this morning, that's exactly how it played out. They jumped that bear. The young dog barked a couple times. Occasionally, they would bark once or twice when the track is super hot, or they can actually see the bear running away. And then they go quiet again until they gain, you know. But I heard a couple barks that tells me it's probably a bear. And then I see on Garmin that whatever they're chasing is running away like a bear. So I'm thinking, okay, that's got to be a bear. It gets to that 700 yard chase mark, I'm thinking we're probably going to lose it because it's 11 o'clock in the morning. It's like close to 75, 80 degrees maybe at that point. Sure enough, 850, 900 yards, they just turn around. Now, the reason they do that, maybe, is it intelligence? Is it because they've done it before over a mile and they never, because if they find a runner, he'll outrun them.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Do you think it's because the bear got a head start and they weren't able to get teeth to him to get caught with him?
Well, maybe. It could be. I can't really say for sure. But I think it's either because they've chased younger ones before and it just doesn't work out, uh-huh, in the hot, you know, on a hot day.
Yeah.
And it also could be, and this is where the intelligence might play out, if they, let's say, if they stopped chasing at 850 yards, 850. If they were to continue chasing and they would have caught up with it at 1,200 yards, then they need to engage. Then when the bear charges back, they still have to have strength enough to evade,
right,
to escape. And maybe that's where their intelligent part kicks in and says, if we continue on, we're tired because it's, you know, they're running fast. If we continue on and if we, you know, catch that bear and we need to engage, then we might potentially get in trouble because we won't be able to move fast enough to,
right,
escape. Maybe that's part of it. I don't know. But the bottom line, occasionally it happens. Seldom, very seldom. So yeah. I don't really.
Yeah, I get it. I mean, I just tell you, I haven't. It's been too. I've seen bear about every day. I have. Caught a nice bear on the ground, got some dogs injured. And today, little bear, probably wasn't 80, 90 pounds, mm-hmm, ringing wet.
Do you actually see it?
Yeah, across the road.
Oh, right, okay, running. Okay, yeah. Okay, gotcha.
The area we hunt, there's got several roads, mm-hmm, and if they cross out of a valley, they're going to cross. Mm-hmm. And we seen the bear, and I mean, I don't know what's going on, but I'm not getting them caught.
Mm-hmm. Well, because, again, could be... I don't know. Maybe your dogs are not putting enough pressure because it's hot.
Yeah.
And they just don't feel, you know, strong enough at that point or enough strength left in them.
It's very frustrating because I was catching bear pretty consistent, stringing them pretty consistently. And like I said, now, and I didn't get to hunt a couple days. I had COVID, so I was out for 4 or 5 days. And, I mean, just not, like... I don't know, and I'm down three dogs. I got one of my Kate's in heat, and Trip got hurt on that bear, and he's out probably till December. I'm not even going to try to run him until December. And then my other little female, she got staples all up her rear end and in her back. So I'm down to three dogs. One of the three dogs is not the fastest dog in the world. And then I got Spook, who outruns the other two.
Right.
So I don't know what's going on, but it's discouraging.
Well, yeah, it's
yeah.
But you have other hunters that you can tag along, mm-hmm. and you know, so yeah. that helps, I'm sure. Yeah. So yeah. it's not like that season is gonna you're gonna miss out on the season.
No, we got a couple more days, and then the early season.
Right, I'm excited.
Yeah.
Can I do my...
Yeah, Alex, so that's what I was going to say. If you if you were going to say something about your dogs...
Oh, I have a secret agenda, yeah. I do. Hidden agenda.
If you were going to say something to wrap this up, what would you tell our listeners? What would you say? What? Just put
right.
it on.
Okay, yeah, and I'll try to keep it short. My whole hidden agenda, which I guess it's not that hidden once I, mm-hmm. you know, share it with you, but I'm trying to promote bear hunting with West Siberian Laikas or Karelian bear dogs or Laikas in general. It can be done. It can be successful. We treat 36, 37 bears last season, and so far this season I'm up to 14 or 17. So it can be done. Sorry, hold on a sec. 17 bears so far this season. That's with in March... I started keeping the log in March. I went to West Virginia as non-residents. Uh-huh. We can run in up until end of March.
Right.
Anyhow, it can be done. I live just outside D.C., mm-hmm. and yet I can still – and I, for me to get to more or less – to the closest, nearest national forest is about an hour and a half from me. And it's not the most – It's not like the prime bear country. And needless to say, most local bear hunters that live closer to in that Northern Virginia area, that's where they go most of the time. So mm-hmm. those bears are pressured. Yet we still manage to do it. So it can be done. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to promote bear hunting, this new style of hunting. And the cons... The negative sides of that are they're not cold-nosed like your hounds. They will never come anywhere close to a cold or to a nose of a hound. So sometimes we go for 6-10 miles and not a single bark.
Uh-huh.
It happens sometimes, and it's just it is what it is. But again, if it does happen, it happens quick. And then the positives, though, you only need two dogs so that it's a lot cheaper to feed them. It's mm-hmm. easier to handle them, to train them. The only training I've done basically is just a very basic obedience. Recall, jump in the truck, and stop barking at the squirrels in my backyard. That's about it. Oh, and I guess not chasing deer. So easy to train, only two dogs to feed. You don't need a truck. All of my hunts, they start from a trailhead from a parking lot that's either gravel or, you know, asphalt. You can have a Prius, you can have a car with one dog box, you know, one of those airline approved crates.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. That's how the last year I had two dogs. And the only reason I have more dogs because I needed a male, right? That's the main mm-hmm. reason I went back to Europe, to Russia, and brought more dogs because I wanted to find a male that would be a bear dog as well so I can breed him. Which... If I am going to breed them, initially I wanted to do it this year, but even I was thinking about last year, and now I'm thinking this year, but now I'm thinking I'm going to do it. If I'm going to do this, it's going to be next year. Mm-hmm. I want this male to prove himself first. Anyway, so another things in favor of this style of hunting, I guess, you don't need a truck. You need a Garmin or any kind of tracking device.
Mm-hmm.
You can control, like I can control my dogs. Even if I'm hunting small parcels, like let's say I'm hunting some private land for raccoon in uh-huh. the winter, in January, February, it can be 20 acre lot. And my dogs never leave that 20 acres. I see them going, I beep or I whistle or I call them, they come back. So it's really, I don't have a problem, even though in Virginia we have right to retrieve.
Yeah.
You know, I try not to use that as much as possible so there's no conflicts.
Right.
But if I must, I would. But again, it's easy to control those dogs. They're there. They're next to you. And if there's a raccoon, because they're so quiet, you can treat that raccoon on a 20-acre lot, no problem. What else? Yeah, so just one crate, a pair of hiking boots, and two dogs. And you start hiking. And I always say, if there is a bear on that mountain, they'll find it. And another thing, the last thing I'm going to say, we're kind of going back, one thing I've kind of failed to mention, the style of hunting. Yes, they're considered hot-nosed, but it's not the only thing that they use. They use their eyesight and they use their hearing. We've had bears treed early morning. We're walking down along the creek, which is not because of thermals. You kind of want to be on the ridge top because you'll start, the sun comes out, the thermals start taking the air up. We're following the bottom of this holler. All of a sudden, we're quiet. All of a sudden, about some 100 yards up or whatever, somewhere up above us, we hear a branch snap. It's one of those quiet mornings. Uh-huh. We hear a branch snap. Immediately, my dogs and I look up. You know, I'm still trying to process what just happened. The dogs are not thinking. They're just going. Uh-huh. And then several seconds later, they're treed.
Yep.
There's no way they could have seen it. There's no way they could have smelled it. It's just... they heard one branch snap, we treat that bear. Another thing was, again, we're quiet. And I always say it's usually we're more successful towards the end of the hunt because if I bring someone along, people like to talk. You know, they start talking.
By the time you walk them to death, you've got them quiet.
Exactly, yes. So most of the time we're successful on the way back to the truck. And I'm started keeping the log where I describe how the hunt went, and I'm already seeing that pattern because people are tired. They're not walking and talking anymore. Yeah. And that's when it happens because it happened before where we're tired. We're going like, you know, the trail switches back going up or down the mountain. We kind of go around this curve, and I look up, and there's a bear standing like 40 yards in front of me. The dog next to me, they see it, they go after it. Doesn't matter where the wind's blowing, doesn't matter. They saw it, they went after it, which I guess any dog at that point would do it. But still, hearing is a big thing. We would be on the ridge top, they would stop. And they're panting, it's hot, but they want to listen. So they hold their breath. Yep. I'm holding my breath. And, let's say someone's with me and they're moving in the leaves and they'll be like, just stop. And then it goes quiet, and dogs just listen, and it would either go down or move on, or they go chasing something. So different style of hunting can be effective. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say as effective, more or less effective, but it can be effective on bear hunting. And, again, if it's only two dogs, and they're very low maintenance, I just do rabies shots, Lyme, and the basic stuff, and ticks, flea. Mm-hmm. I give him Bravecta.
Yep, same thing.
That's about pretty much it.
Well, I mean, I really like I've got 13 dogs out here. Three of them are pups, and then I've got my police dogs. But I mean, my perfect pack is four dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I could get down to four dogs, that's where I would like to be. But I've always got a young dog coming, so then it ends up being five.
Yeah.
And then I've got an old dog that I feel guilty about, so I throw him in there, and I've got six. So that's kind of where I'm at right now. I'm running six. But, yeah, just the sheer pleasure of not having to handle six dogs and do this.
And that's the thing. I go by myself most of the time.
Right.
You know, during off-season or at night coon hunting, I go by myself. Yep. So if I had several dogs, that's just...
Yeah.
Especially when I hunt those small WMAs where I park along... basically like 20 yards from a highway, you know, I have to, now with two dogs, I don't even put them on the leash. I probably should, but I can control them. As we're going back to the parking lot, I kind of beep them or I whistle and they come back to me and they stay next to me.
Yeah.
But having three, four dogs, which I have four dogs now, but one of them is a squirrel dog. She's just a little too timid for a bear. And then the young one, the young male.
Yep.
So the only reason I have three dogs now, because again, I have that male that I want to,
right.
I hope he is going to become a bear dog, but that's it. Yeah. So it's,
well, Alex, we appreciate you coming. And I mean, you know, you drove down here, sit down with us and, you know, learn about the Leicas and, you know, again, it still reminds me of my great granddad's elk hounds. The coloration's different. His were gray, had a little white in them.
Mm-hmm.
But in the nose, like I said, the nose of your dog, like reminds me of the Yoke Coyote. Like it had that, like it stuck out to me just immediately. Yeah. But I appreciate it. You know, hopefully the listeners will take something from it. I mean, these dogs were natural. You did nothing but take them in the woods, and they done it on their own. Hmm. And it, the progression, I mean, that's what the journey's about is, you know, hunting and training is a journey. It's a progression. Your dog started training possums and then squirrels and then raccoons. And then, you know, year and a half, 2 years old, they're training bear. And, you know, if everybody would understand that, that everything's a process. Mm-hmm. Some do it faster, some do it slower, and some take a lot of stuff in between. But yeah, I enjoyed the conversation. Like I said, I enjoyed learning about the Leicas, and like I said, enjoy. Thank you for coming down. And it, like I said, at the end of every podcast, we say, Alex, thank you for helping us teach, train, and definitely learn about the Leicas and the Leica breed.
No problem. Thank you so much.